Kim. She is the Mary Milas Yeo and Harold L. Yeo Jr. Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Duke University. Dr. Shi Kim specializes in environmental, aquatic chemistry, and geochemistry. Her research tackles problems related to metal pollution and biogeochemical processes that alter their distribution in water, soil, and air. The application of this work includes environmental remediation technologies, the impact of energy production on water resources, global environmental health, and the environmental implications and applications of nanotechnology. Her current research projects are focused on mercury biogeochemistry, the environmental implications of nanomaterials, the impact of coal ash disposal on water quality, and recovering valuable materials from coal ash wastes. She has a Bachelor's of Science degree in Environmental Engineering Science from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, an MS and PhD in Environmental Engineering from the University of California, Berkeley, and completed a postdoc in marine science at the University of Delaware. At this point, I will turn the presentation over to Helen.
Great. Thank you very much for that introduction, Chris. I guess I'll get started on my presentation, and I wanted to mention that this is a summary of a project that my team has been working on over the last few years titled Strategies for Quantifying Mercury Biomethylation Potential in Sediments. And as part of this project team, I have my colleague Mark Deschutes here at Duke University, as well as our collaborator Duane Elias at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. This work is a summary of the work of our research trainees, including Yudi Nadeau, Natalia Neal-Walthall, Jeff Christensen, and Caitlin Gianfrido. And of course, this is supported by the NIEHS Superfund research program. So in this presentation, what I'm going to be talking about is the production of methylmercury in the aquatic environment. As this slide says, methylmercury production is often, or methylmercury levels are often a driver of risk at contaminated sediment sites where mercury is a constituent of interest. Methylmercury is an issue because this form of mercury is capable of biomagnifying in the aquatic food web, and then serving as a risk to people who eat contaminated fish and other kinds of aquatic organisms that have high levels of methylmercury. And methylmercury is actually naturally produced in the environment, mainly by anaerobic microorganisms that would be prevalent in benthic settings, such as sediment settings. So the research of my group, or of this project, is focused mostly on this process of methylmercury production in benthic environments, this process of methylation. So, in contaminated sites, another challenge related to mercury is that the cost of cleanup at contaminated sites is really quite exorbitant. For example, these are just three examples of contaminated sites around the country where the estimated cleanup for the mercury problems is estimated in the hundreds of millions or more. And at these sites, one of the key concerns is understanding how cleanup activities or decisions for cleanup can impact methylmercury levels in these settings. And it's often methylmercury levels that we are concerned about in terms of understanding the types of cleanup decisions that we make at these sites. So the thing is that there's many challenges in understanding or managing mercury contaminated sites. And one of these challenges is to develop appropriate benchmarks for site assessment. So on this slide, what I'm showing here is that a summary of a wide variety of data taken from dozens of research papers looking at mercury levels at various contaminated sites. And in this graph shown here, what we're summarizing are total mercury levels in sediments as well as methylmercury levels in those same samples for a variety of sites that have been impacted by mercury in different ways, including industrial historical legacy contamination, as well as mining and other kinds of issues. And what this graph is really showing is how total mercury content rarely, or methylmercury content in sediments, rarely correlates with total mercury content. And actually, total mercury content is then a poor predictor of risk. And this is kind of taking this data along with the current challenge in that actual water quality standards at mercury contaminated sites is actually a fish-based standard. It's that the water quality metric is actually methylmercury concentration in fish. And the reason for this standard is because of this standard is actually a direct reflection of the risk to people and that's in the exposure route in which people are exposed to methylmercury. Now, the problem with this standard of methylmercury concentration in fish is that any action taken at a site and would reduce the methylmercury in fish, but there's a time lag between the action taken at a site, for example, any kind of in situ remediation plan implemented, and there's a time delay to what would be observed in terms of methylmercury concentration in the actual fish, which is the water quality standard. So this brings us to our need, is that what we need is actually a more functional, shorter-term target or benchmark that can be used to help make these decisions for watershed management and remediation. And I would argue that one of these benchmarks would be something that tells us something about biomethylation potential of mercury at a given site. So it's this benchmark or this need or this idea of developing a way to quantify mercury biomethylation potential. That is the focus of the research that I'll be presenting here. So the question is, well, why do we need a model to predict mercury biomethylation potential? You know, ideally what you can measure is just the amount of methylmercury or the relative amount of methylmercury at any given site. And so, for example, what I've shown here are two factors that actually contribute to these percent methylmercury levels in a given environment. One is shown on the vertical axis, just the amount of methylating microorganisms that would be present that contribute to methylmercury production. So in any given setting, if you have high methylation, high productivity organisms, you would ostensibly have high methylation potential. And the opposite in the case of low productivity of these organisms, you'd have low percent methylmercury levels. But the bioavailability of the inorganic mercury, which is shown on the horizontal axis, is also an important contributor to overall methylmercury levels. And so methylation, mercury methylation potential is actually the combination of the productivity of these methylating organisms as well as the bioavailability of this inorganic mercury. And at a given site, you can actually have one of these two factors as what I call the dominant factor controlling methylmercury levels. So for example, in a site that's, for example, like a mesohaline or a brackish salt marsh, you could have a high productivity of methylating organisms as well as high inorganic mercury availability, leading to high percentage of methylmercury, percent of methylmercury, or a high rate of methylmercury production. In cases of moderate percent methylmercury levels, for example, this contaminated tidal marsh that is contaminated with metacinnabar or mercury sulfides, you would have a low mercury availability, but a high productivity of organisms leading to a certain percentage of methylmercury. But this would contrast to a different kind of ecosystem that would be, say, a low-order stream that has a high availability of mercury coming from, say, an industrial elemental mercury discharge, but a low extent of methylmercury production and leading to a similar percentage as methylmercury. And so understanding where you would lie on this spectrum is important in terms of the impact for, or at least understanding the impact of remediation and other kinds of perturbations. So for example, you could have a perturbation such as a flooding event that would change the extent of methylation for a different reason than another perturbation event, such as the addition of activated carbon as a sediment amendment, which would change the availability, or we hypothesize it would change the availability of the inorganic mercury. So with that, what we're looking for are models. What we are focused on, let me go back a slide, what our project is focused on is specifically looking at ways in which we can quantify one axis of this risk profile, particularly the availability, bioavailability part. And then towards the end, I'll show you some preliminary work that our group has done to try to develop metrics for this vertical axis, the mercury productivity of the methylating microbes part. So let's go to the models for quantifying mercury bioavailability. And there's different approaches that have been proposed in the past. One method that has been proposed is actually to use chemical equilibrium speciation models as a way to model the bioavailable form of inorganic mercury to methylating microorganisms. So just to remind you, if you don't know, that the methylating microorganisms, as I'm showing here with the arrow, are anaerobic, are a wide variety of anaerobic microorganisms. All of them have the genes that encode these proteins, ACCA and ACCB, that are part of the proteins that are necessary for converting inorganic mercury to methylmercury. And the organisms that possess these genes and this trait of methylating mercury are all kinds of anaerobes, including sulfate reducers, iron reducers, and methanogens. And it's been hypothesized that only a subset of the inorganic mercury pool that are in these anaerobic habitats are available to these organisms. A previous hypothesis would use chemical equilibrium as a way to model the partitioning of inorganic mercury between these different dissolved phases and particulate phases. So chemical equilibrium models that would include complexation models, as well as phase partitioning, like such as solubility or partition coefficients. And then a subset of these models, of these forms, of the dissolved forms, would be available. Now, the challenge with this approach is that we lack good ways to actually quantify or appropriately partition the soluble form of mercury in sediments. So for example, here I'm showing some data where we took sediments from a freshwater lake and tried to quantify the dissolved fraction of mercury in these sediments. So a common way to do this would be to say, take these sediments or the pore water of the sediments and filter it with like a 0.2 micron filter. And if we did that, when we did that with this sediment, we got about 1,000 nanograms per liter of mercury in this filter passing fraction, which you would presume to be dissolved. But if we process the sample in a different way, for example, centrifuging, and this is just data centrifuging at different speeds and different time frames, we get different amounts of mercury that is in the supernatant that could also count as, quote, the dissolved fraction. And this third centrifuging, which is 370,000 Gs for 2 hours, what we're getting out here in the centrifuging are all particulate forms greater than a few nanometers in diameter or more. And what we observed in this case is almost zero or not non-detectable amounts of mercury in this supernatant. So basically what this data is showing is that most of the mercury that exists in what we call pore water is probably bound to particles, colloidal particles. And inorganic mercury has a really high partitioning to particulates in sediments. So this makes the chemical equilibrium approach difficult because we don't have good ways of quantifying the, quote, truly dissolved fraction. And actually, the mercury is actually mostly bound to particles. So the other thing is that because inorganic mercury is primarily bound to particles, the particulate fraction actually spans a wide spectrum of different species, including, so if you were to have mercury that was precipitating in pore water, its initial precipitation products would ostensibly be associated with sulfides or other kinds of organic matter type compounds. So you would have these amorphous particles of mercury sulfides or mercury organic matter particles that are initially amorphous in terms of their crystal structure. And over time, these particles would crystallize through aging or ripening processes. And the particles, which would start out small, would also aggregate over time. And all of these different forms have the ability to redissolve into solution, but would redissolve at different rates. And so what we're our work is really shown is that the rates of these reactions at microbial interfaces is what determines inorganic mercury bioavailability for methylation. And so that leads us to the methods that our project has developed in terms of quantifying inorganic mercury bioavailability to methylating microorganisms. I'm going to be presenting work of two different methods our project had looked at. Both of these are actually falling on this conceptual model that we have envisioned of the processes that are controlling mercury availability to methylators. Particularly, we're looking at the idea that you have various forms of inorganic mercury in sediments that span a spectrum of dissolved nanoscale or nanocrystalline and macrocrystalline based particles. And the availability of these inorganic mercury depends on its reactivity at the surface of a microorganism, where that organism would have a sulfhydryl-based biotic ligand that would be that would be taking up the mercury, or at least allowing it to partition onto the organism's surface. So the first method that we have is what I call a file-based selective extraction. This is modeled off of selective extractions that people have developed using, say, a strong base or a strong acid to extract out mercury out of sediments and then say something about the chemical form of that mercury. In this case, we're using an extractant that is based that contains glutathione, a sulfhydryl-containing low molecular weight polypeptide. Glutathione, when it binds to dissolved mercury, forms a soluble form of mercury. And so what we've done is, the idea here is we take a sediment sample, expose it to 1 millimolar, this 1 millimolar solution of glutathione, mix it for a short time frame, and looked at the extractable fraction by quantifying the increase in mercury in the aqueous fraction of this extract. So that's one method that we're proposing. The second method that we're proposing, or that we've looked at, are diffusive gradient and thin film samplers. These are passive samplers that researchers have used and developed and used over the last several years to look at or to try to quantify the soluble metal fraction in soils and water. The way these passive samplers work are they comprise of these layered housings that comprise a resin metal binding layer layered over top of a diffusion layer. For us, we use agarose, and then also a 0.45 membrane filter. And all of these are encased in this polypropylene housing. This is what kind of a schematic of what it would look like when it's all encased. And the way people have used this in the past is actually to try to quantify the, quote, truly dissolved concentration of the metal from which these passive samplers are sampling. So in this case, this resin layer here would act as an infinite sink for the metal, creating a concentration gradient with distance within the sampler, as I'm showing here on this graph. So you have the dissolved metal concentration in solution and this concentration gradient in the passive sampler. And the way people have used these DGTs in the past is to model this concentration gradient assuming steady state diffusion flux or steady state diffusion kinetics, where the concentration gradient as well as the diffusion properties and the deployment time is directly related to the concentration in bulk solution. So there's quite a bit of work that's been done people have used in practice as well as in research for figuring out how to use these DGTs to get at the soluble concentration. So our group actually has not used this and used these DGTs in this way. There's a lot of debate on whether this process is truly at steady state. Instead, what we're looking at is using these DGT samplers simply as a way of quantifying mercury mass uptake over a given time frame. And the idea here is that we're using this resin layer here where we're using a thiolated silica resin that we synthesize ourselves in our group as a way of modeling the surface of a microorganism, or at least it's been inspired by our conceptual model that the surface of a methylating microorganism comprises of these thiolated functional groups that can bind mercury. So in this case, we're looking at mass uptake rate or flux into the sampler as the parameter that we're measuring. And we're proposing that this mass uptake of mercury into these passive samplers is proportional to the reactive mercury fraction or the bioavailable mercury fraction for methylation. So what I'm going to show you next are some experiments that we've done to sort of test these two different methods. So these two methods, the DGT samplers and the glutathione selective extraction, were tested first in these jar experiments, what we're calling sediment microcosms. So these are sediment slurries that were made using sediments from a tidal marsh. Actually, we did this two times, sediments with a tidal marsh, and then a second time with sediments from a freshwater lake. And in these experiments, we added different forms of inorganic mercury that are each isotopically labeled two different dissolved forms of inorganic mercury, mercury dissolved nitrate and mercury dissolved mercury bound to humic acid, and then two particulate forms of mercury, that's mercury adsorbed to iron sulfide particles, and then nanocrystalline mercury sulfide that is coated with humic acid. And we use these different forms mostly to span a spectrum of bioavailability, knowing that the dissolved mercury forms should get methylated faster than the forms of mercury that started out as particles. And so in these cases, we put in the DDT, as these pictures show, and over time, we quantify the amount of methylmercury that is generated from each isotope spike, as well as the inorganic mercury that accumulates on the DDTs, the mercury that is in this glutathione extractable fraction. And then also, we looked at the microbial community composition, particularly for the copies of these genes, HCCA, the gene that is necessary for mercury methylation. So let me show you the results of the experiments, these sediment slurry experiments. This is with the slurries with the sediment from the tidal marsh, where on the left, we're plotting the amount of methylmercury produced from each isotope spike over time. And you can see in the black and blue symbols that these are the spikes from the inorganic mercury, and they get methylated to a greater extent than the forms of mercury coming from the particles, which are the red and white symbols. And then on the right here, we're showing uptake of the mercury into the DDTs over time, and we also see the dissolved mercury forms get taken out faster than the initially particulate mercury forms. Okay, and so if we take these two data, both of those graphs, and plot them together through these correlations, that's what this left-hand figure is showing, is the for each time point, the amount of methylmercury produced from each isotope spike, and then the mercury taken up onto the DDT. And so each color is a different time point. Each symbol for each color is actually one of those isotope spikes. And what we observe is this correlation between mercury uptake into the DDT and then methylmercury conversion to methylmercury. On the right, we're showing the same data in terms of methylmercury, but on the horizontal axis are different ways of that you might quantify bioavailability. In this case, this is just the mercury that passes through a 0.45 micron filter, the filter passing mercury fraction, or what would be conventionally called, sometimes called the dissolved fraction. In this case, you can see there's no correlation. The dots are all over the place. There's no correlation with methylmercury. And then on the bottom is plotting the extractable, glutathione extractable fraction, and we also don't see a correlation. So altogether, this data is suggesting that mercury uptake into a DDT sampler is correlating with extent of methylation, or the bioavailability of that mercury for methylation. This experiment was repeated with a different kind of sediment, in this case a freshwater lake. The same experiment, we added an electron donor, pyruvate, to really ramp up the amount of methylators in these slurries. And we did the same thing. We added different types of mercury, tracked the conversion to methylmercury over time, and then also looked at things like uptake into the DDT. So that's the graph on the right where you can see that there is a correlation between the amount converted to methylmercury and then the amount of mercury on the DDT. Not a very good correlation with the filter passing fraction. And then in this case, we have a correlation with the glutathione extractable fraction. Okay, so altogether, I think this, these data are showing a lot of promise for the DDTs, much less promise for this glutathione extractable fraction. So our work in the future is actually focused more on the DDTs than this other method. One thing I do want to mention is that we repeated these experiments twice, these slurry experiments twice, testing the DDTs, and in both cases we get correlations between the amount of mercury on these DDTs and the extent of methylation. But what you'll notice is that the slopes of these correlations, the slopes of the mesohaline slurry and the freshwater lake slurry, are very different. And so we might be able to reasonably say, well, because the reason for these different slopes is because of the microbial communities within each slurry. So in other words, the difference between the two graphs Is it because we have differences in the abundance of methylating microorganisms, as might be indicated by this gene HCCA and HCCB? So to answer this, this allows us, the fact that we have these two different data sets allows us to move forward in perhaps applying biomolecular tools to really get at quantifying the anaerobic microbiome of methylators. So this graph is showing kind of more conceptually the our vision of how there's two main controls on mercury methylation. The inorganic mercury speciation part, which is what the initial part of our project has focused on, understanding or quantifying the bioavailable fraction of inorganic mercury. And then you have the second part, which is the anaerobic microbiome of methylators, where in an anaerobic microbial community, you would have a subset of these organisms that are capable of producing methylmercury. And so in this case, what we did was we tested qPCR-based methods that target these genes, HCCA in particular, as maybe as a way of quantifying the methylating microorganisms. So this is the work from those two slurries where we used, as I mentioned, qPCR to quantify the copy number of HCCA in these two slurries. And the top graph on the right is showing the abundance of the delta proteobacteria methylators. So these are mostly sulfate reducers and iron reducers. And the bottom graph are the gene copy numbers for the methanogenic methylators, the HCCA methanogen plus methanogens. And the main result of these measurements was a bit inconclusive, because what we've realized is that in the for the delta proteobacteria, which as I mentioned is mostly sulfate reducers and iron reducers, we observe much more of them in these mesohaline slurries and the freshwater slurries, which is what we would expect. There's much more sulfate in the mesohaline slurries than the freshwater slurries. But as you notice on the graph on the left, the methylation rates here are much less in the mesohaline slurries. So the percentages here are much less than the percentages in the freshwater slurries. And what we observe with the methanogenic qPCR data is that there's much more methanogenic methylators in the freshwater slurries. So basically, this qPCR data is basically saying that the methylators in the freshwater slurries are mostly methanogens. The methylators in the mesohaline slurries are probably mostly sulfate reducers. But we can't use, as of yet, these RQPCR-based techniques to differentiate or compare the copy numbers of the delta proteobacteria directly with the copy number of the methanogenic methylators. So we can't, from an absolute scale, compare these numbers to these numbers quite yet. So that's still work ongoing. Another ongoing work is to actually understand this efficacy of the DDTs for predicting inorganic mercury bioavailability from methylation. So basically, can these DDTs work in the real world, in real field settings? So what we're doing is actually using the same design as our sediment slurry experiments, but actually testing these in outdoor field experiments. In this case, we have these freshwater wetland mesocosms that are located near my university at Duke, where we have these boxes about 1 meter by 3 meters long that have been planted with freshwater organisms, including macrophytes, as well as other kinds of critters, and spike them all with these different isotopically labeled inorganic mercury forms. And then we've tracked the extent of conversion to methylmercury in these mesocosms, as well as uptake into passive samplers, and also mercury uptake into the macrofauna within these mesocosms. And the data here is just a sampling of our initial data from the experiment. This is data taken about 2 months after we added the mercury to the mesocosms, where we've measured methylmercury in the sediments of these of three different mesocosm boxes. Each dot is one of the isotopes. And then we've also measured inorganic mercury flux into a DDT. So these are DDTs that are laid out in these boxes for about 6 or 7 days. And what I'm plotting here is just inorganic mercury flux into these DDTs. And what we can see here is that for each mesocosm box, we have a correlation between methylmercury from each isotope and then inorganic mercury flux into the DDT. So that's the same for each box. But when you compare across boxes, you can see that there's differences between boxes. And we think this has to do with the biological variability between boxes. So for example, mesocosm 1 likely has something with these sediments might be slightly more active in terms of the methylators than mesocosm box 3, which is slightly less active. And then also our next step in terms of what we're really hoping to achieve is some kind of model for methylation potential, where it can be semi-mechanistic based on these markers that we've established. For example, a kinetic model of methylmercury production that depends on the availability of mercury, say the bioavailable mercury flux as indicated by DDTs, and then some parameter that indicates the abundance or activity of the methylators, perhaps using these genetic probes that are still being developed. And then you have to also include this demethylation part, which our product didn't address, but we recognize that it's going to be necessary to figure out in terms of coming up for an overall model for mercury methylation. So just in summary, our work has, or at least I hope this presentation, you've learned a few things. One is that in terms of dealing with mercury-contaminated sites, a great need is developing functional measures for methylmercury production potential. I hope you've learned that in terms of understanding what controls mercury bioavailability for methylation, really this process is controlled by the reactivity of mercury sulfide organic matter phases at microbial interfaces, and we believe this is a kinetically controlled process. And then finally, our project specifically looked at various ways for quantifying methylmercury production potential, specifically uptake rate into DDTs, which looks very promising. And then we're still developing biomarker tools for understanding the productivity of these methylene organisms. So I'll end there, and my slide here has my contact information, and I would be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Helen. That was a great presentation. Let's see. So if you haven't already done so, you can submit your questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner. And I will read them out loud as they come in. While we're waiting, quick question that I have. Regarding those DGTs that you're using, are those commercially available at this point, or is that something that you manufacture in-house?
The DDTs are commercially available. We purchase the housing and then the plastic case and then synthesize the inside materials ourselves, so the agarose gel, and we thiolate our own, we manufacture our own thiolated resin for the resin layer. And then we assemble them ourselves in our lab, but the casing and the filters are commercially available.
Okay, thanks. All right, we've got some questions coming in here. First question, how can we put the results of your work into practice to address remedial solutions in the absence of a complete model prediction in a given sediment environment?
Right. Is that the end?
That is the end. Sorry.
Okay. So our work was really to try to come up with improved tools to assess the site, particularly for understanding the bioavailability of mercury for methylation. And I think the practical application of this work is that right now we don't have great tools to do that. So what we're hoping is that the tools that we have tested, in particular something like a DGT, can actually give you an idea of the bioavailability of inorganic mercury at a site. And with that information, you can make some decisions about how to implement or better control methylmercury levels. So, for example, if you're dealing with a site in which
you know, you can observe the methylmercury levels, but the bioavailable mercury, inorganic mercury, is actually really low. That would give you a different, that would kind of narrow down the types of actions you would take at a site. You probably wouldn't be doing things like, say, adding activated carbon to try to even further reduce the available bioavailable mercury because it's already very low. And in fact, you might be doing other things to sort of actually decrease the activity of the methylators. So I guess, you know, the story is that I think these tools that we're testing can actually provide information that is then can be applied so that you can make the right kind of decision of in terms of and you can gain an understanding of what's controlling methylmercury levels at a given site. So then you can make decisions on what kinds of actions to take.
Sounds good. I've got a bunch more questions coming in here. The next question is mercury methylation reversible?
Methylmercury can degrade in the environment or can be lost from sediments, I'll say that. There's different ways. It could be transported out, you know, through advective or diffusive processes. It can be taken up in biota. And then methylmercury can also be decomposed to back to inorganic mercury. This process of methylmercury decomposition is both thought to be both biological and a chemical process. So there's methylmercury decomposition by sunlight, by processes that might involve sulfides. And then there's also decomposition of methylmercury by organisms, microorganisms, particularly a subset of microorganisms that contain the machinery or genes that can that are for mercury detoxification. So there are definitely ways in which you can lose methylmercury in a system. Yes.
Thanks. I've got another question here. Says, any plans to consider how the DGT outcomes compare to biological tissue uptake? And I wonder if that's thinking about biological uptake at the base of the food web or maybe just correlations between the DGT concentrations and fish tissue concentrations in a particular ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, there's been already a decent amount of work looking at mercury and DDTs and what it means for tissue uptake, for example, of macrofauna like benthic insects and worms and maybe even fish. So we're not the only ones looking at this, but we are looking at this, yes. The answer is yes to that. It's mostly in our mesocosm experiments where we have a simulated wetland ecosystem that, you know, is a functioning food web in there. In this case, we're looking at methylmercury uptake into a DDT and what that would mean for methylmercury bioaccumulation in macrofauna, like snails and plants and the mosquito fish that have been populated in these mesocosms.
Sounds good. I've got another question here. How comprehensive are the four forms of mercury that you tested, inorganic, organic, et cetera, in terms of trusting them to represent natural conditions?
Well, I mean, I guess we picked these four forms mostly to purposely span a spectrum of availability. So we're not saying that mercury exists only in these four forms. We just know that if they start out dissolved, they get methylated faster than if they start out as particles. Keeping in mind that once you add these four forms into a jar of mud or a wetland, they all will repartition into different, you know, redissolve or precipitate or absorb the particles. They'll repartition over time. But because they start out initially at different phases, the extent in which that the mercury is available for organisms will change because the process of bioavailability is a rate-based process. It depends on the rate of that repartitioning. This is not meant to describe or be comprehensive, although I think I think it is comprehensive in spanning a spectrum of reactivity. Mercury associated with sulfide particles tends to be much less reactive than mercury that it would be bound to dissolve humic acid, for example.
Sounds good. Thanks. And I think maybe we'll do one more question from the series here. And it's another one related to demethylation. The question is, much of the folks you work is on methylmercury production. How does demethylation figure into our understanding of the extent to which methylmercury gets into the food web? And you've kind of addressed that already, but if you have any other additional thoughts on the demethylation process.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so, you know, in this slide we're showing here methylmercury in sediment, which is kind of like this bulk parameter that is important in terms of the risk of the environment. And what we've measured is really just one component that leads to methylmercury levels. It's the inorganic mercury part. But what reflects this bulk, this actual bulk measurement, is actually does include the extent of methylmercury degradation or demethylation. So, you know, our project hasn't really touched that, I think mostly because the processes that cause methylmercury decomposition has yet to be fully worked out. We don't really know from a mechanistic level how methylmercury is degraded in benthic environments, in anaerobic environments. We know some processes, but not all of them. And so I think this work might actually lead to methylmercury degradation, partly because, so, you know, in this example, for example, you know, we have three different mesocosm boxes. We're actually measuring inorganic mercury bioavailability, but the differences between the boxes are probably due to not only the amount of methylators, but also the extent of demethylation that could be occurring in the boxes and then would also then be different from the boxes. So I think we're eventually going to go in that direction of understanding methylmercury degradation, but it's definitely an important part that needs to be addressed before we can come up with this overarching model for methylation potential.
Okay, thanks. That sounds good. Now, I think that's all the questions we'll take for Helen's presentation. Right now, we'll move on to Upal's discussion, or to Upal's presentation. Although we may have a few minutes left at the very end of both presentations, if you have any additional questions for Helen, then certainly feel free to write those in during this presentation, and we might have a chance to address those afterwards. And if not, then she can address those via email. Okay, so next we will hear from Dr. Upal Ghosh, a professor in the Department of Chemical, Biochemical, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His group explores fundamental process mechanisms that control pollutant fate in soil, sediment, and aquatic environments. They use multidisciplinary tools to investigate exposure and bioavailability of inorganic and metal pollutants to organisms. This new information is used to develop novel remediation technologies and site-specific remediation goals. Recent projects have focused on contaminants such as PCBs, PAHs, pesticides, dioxins, and mercury. Dr. Ghosh has a Bachelor's of Technology degree in Chemical Engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay, India, and Master's of Science and PhD in Civil and Environmental Engineering from the State University of New York at Buffalo, and completed a postdoc at Carnegie Mellon University, and has also worked as a research associate at Stanford University. Upal, I will now turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you. I just unmuted myself. Am I audible?
Sounds good.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone, and thanks to Helen for great presentation and also introducing mercury and methylmercury in the environment. So I'm going to jump right on into a topic that I decided to talk about, which is in situ remediation, focused on our work on in situ remediation for mercury. This work we have been involved in over maybe about a decade or so, and focus of the talk today is going to be the NIH-funded work that we did in the last 3 to 4 years, and this has involved an active collaboration with a group at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center with Cindy Gilmore, who is a co-PI on this project with me, and Dwayne Elias from the University of Tennessee, Oak Ridge National Lab, and Dwayne has been helping us with the molecular probe work. I'm not going to go too much into the molecular probe work in this presentation. This work would not have been possible without the great work done by James Sanders, Grace Schwartz, and Spencer Washburn, PhD and postdocs, trainees at working on this NIH-R01 project. James is now working as a consultant with Exponent. So I'm going to jump right on here on the remediation background and what got us into looking at mercury and methyl mercury contaminant sediments as a way to look at bioavailability manipulation in sediments. Some of you may have seen some of the work that we have done over the years looking at in situ management of contaminated sediments, and the motivation for that comes primarily from the issue of contaminated sediment sites being very large and very expensive to clean up, and the traditional process of cleanup involving dredging has associated risks as well. So the approach here is to be able to understand enough about the geochemistry and the fate and transport of these pollutants so that we are able to implement geoengineering that will allow in-situ manipulation of the sediment geochemistry that can allow us to control the exposure. In a way, if we think about contaminant sediments, except for a few cases where we actually treat and remove the contaminants from sediments, it's a matter of exposure control one way or the other, either putting it in a landfill to control exposure to the ecosystem or humans, or putting it under a cap to control that exposure. In this case, we are looking at a way to control that exposure into the aquatic ecosystem in situ by reducing its transport. And this has been demonstrated quite well with a range of hydrophobic chemicals like PCBs and pesticides, where addition of activated carbon alters the sorption capacity in the sediments that reduces uptake into the benthic organisms or flux into the water column. Now, when we are implementing these projects to control the exposure of strongly hydrophobic chemicals, we all often run into the situation that some of these sediment sites, especially at Superfund sites, have not just hydrophobic organics as the chemicals of concern, but also we often end up with mercury and methyl mercury as additional drivers of risk that needs to be controlled. So the question that we started addressing...
Paul?
Yes?
Hi, I'm sorry to interrupt, but are your slides supposed to be advancing?
Oh. You know what? I started looking at the other slide I have up on my screen. Sorry about that. There we go. Yeah.
No, just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
I have two screens, and I had my own PowerPoint on the other screen. So this is the slide I wanted to talk about. And so the question is, can carbon or biochar sequester mercury and methyl mercury and reduce bioavailability in sediments? And some of the past work is summarized in a feature article that we published several years ago, and I'm happy to send it to anyone who is interested. So we developed a set of aims for this NIH project, and two specific aims. The first one is to develop in-situ remediation tool for mercury and methyl mercury impacted sediments and fill up knowledge gaps that allow us to understand and develop a biogeochemical model that allows us to think about how an in-situ intervention would function for methyl mercury production and degradation in contaminated sediments. I'm going to spend some time talking about our experiences with using carbon as a remedy for in-situ, carbon and other amendments as a remedy for in-situ treatment of mercury and methyl mercury contaminated sediments. And the approach we took for our work involved first looking at how effective a range of carbons, activated carbons and biochars are in binding mercury and methyl mercury, and then taking that understanding to extend that into lab studies where we would take sediments or soils from the field and amend it with the right sorbent and look at how that changes the pore water concentration or biouptake into organisms. Then we moved on to small-scale field studies, and I'll talk about that a little bit, and then additional work to really understand some of the mechanisms that might be responsible for mercury methylation and demethylation once an amendment is added to those sediments. So here is a summary of the initial work we did, characterizing a whole range of activated carbons and biochars. So I should step back here and say a little bit about the biochar and the ACs. So biochar is a we call them black carbons. These are graphitic forms of carbon that you produce from pyrolysis of materials that are organic in nature. And typically when we think about biochar, we are thinking of organic matter in the form of wood or maybe coconut shell or other nut shells that are fresh organic materials that have been produced by the plants. Or it could be an old carbon like coal, which is also a biomass of sorts, but it's ancient biomass, which can also produce a char when it's pyrolyzed, and you get a biochar or you get a coke out of that. Now, these materials have strong sorption capacity on the aromatic surfaces, but they may not have the specific surface area that you would need to have really super strong sorbent properties. So what the industry often does is activate it, which is a process by which additional pore structure is introduced by a controlled oxidation process, which greatly enhances the surface area up to in the range of 1,000 square meters per gram. And that material is typically called activated carbon, which could come from coal or it could come from coconut shell. And those are the two primary raw materials that are used to produce activated carbon. There is a tremendous amount of use in water, drinking water treatment and gas phase treatments. So if we go back and look at in the literature for mercury adsorption, there is some data that's out there in looking at carbon beds for treating industrial wastewater containing mercury. So when you look at those, you find that those concentrations at which those sorption isotherms were performed were in the range of hundreds of milligrams per liter. Those were relevant for industrial wastewater treatment. In environmental samples, in sediments and surface waters, we are often dealing with concentrations that are in the nanograms per liter. So that was a big challenge for us to try to understand and discriminate between different types of carbons in terms of their effectiveness for sorption of mercury and methyl mercury. So our work shown here, which was published several years ago, compares a range of activated carbons and biochars for their sorption capacity at low environmentally relevant concentrations. You can see in the x-axis there, concentrations below, even going down below a nanogram per liter. And the y-axis is the amount that is absorbed onto the carbon. And with that, we were able to compare these different carbons for sorption capacity in the range of concentrations we're interested in for mercury and methyl mercury. So we showed that activated carbons are a stronger sorbent for mercury compared to biochars. But when it comes to methyl mercury, activated carbon and biochars seem to work about equally well. And both of these black carbons are way more stronger in terms of their sorption capacity compared to natural organic materials that one would find in salts and sediments. So those are the green and the orange bars and dots that you see in those figures. Now, these studies were done with inorganic mercury, methyl mercury, and methyl mercury chloride as the added form of mercury or methyl mercury. But as we know, in sediment environments, oftentimes the ligand that typically binds the dissolved mercury is dissolved organic matter. So we wanted to also look at how the sorption capacity is impacted when we have a more realistic sediment pore water environment where dissolved organic matter might be the dominant ligand that binds either the methyl mercury or the mercury. And so in this experiment, we set up a set of isotherms with a range of dissolved organic carbon that as you can see in the bottle set up there. As you go from left to right, you see increasing color there indicating the dissolved organic matter level, and these went up to a little more than 100 milligrams per liter. And we use Swanee River humic acid as the surrogate DOM for these isotherm studies. And the isotherms were conducted with coal or coconut-derived activated carbons. The results show us that in the presence of DOM, the softening capacity is attenuated to some extent, depending on the amount of DOM that's added to the system, anywhere from 1 to 3 orders of magnitude reduction in the softening capacity. So in the presence of high dissolved organic matter, the effectiveness of the carbon is going to be altered. That's a big message that comes out of this work. The other thing is that when the mercury or the methyl mercury is bound to the DOM and we look at the partitioning characteristic into the carbon is somewhat close to what the parent DOM partitions like into that carbon. So that's the mercury is basically getting a ride on the DOM to bind onto the organic onto the activated carbon. With higher DOM levels in the pore water, one might expect to see attenuation of the effectiveness of activated carbon. So with that information, we wanted to see the effectiveness of carbon in a range of site sediments. So this work looked at sediments that are contaminated with mercury that came from a range of field sites. There were 2 freshwater sites and 2 estuarine sites. That the figure on the left shows the results. That first 2, the South River and the lake, these are freshwater, and the 2 on the right are estuarine sediments. And the way we set these experiments up were in buckets in a temperature-controlled room where we had the sediment sitting under a layer of water. And the water was oxygenated to keep the organisms alive. The organisms we used here for bioaccumulation study was the Lambriculus variegatus, which is a freshwater oligochaete that's often used as a for bioaccumulation studies. And they're tolerant to salt to about 4 ppt or so. And these estuarine sediments we are able to maintain at low salt concentrations to allow these oligochaetes to be able to survive and do their work in the sediments. And what you see in the plot on the left, I'm going to pull the arrow here. So we have the 4 sites in the bottom of the axis here, and on the y-axis we have nanograms per gram dry weight of methyl mercury bioaccumulated in the organism after a 28-day exposure study. And there's a range of concentrations that are accumulated in the organism. And what you see here is that for the South River site, which is where the methyl mercury was weakly bound to sediments. So the green circles here are showing the partition constant, ambient methyl mercury partition constants. So at the lowest partition constant, which means the methyl mercury is not very strongly bound to those sediments, addition of activated carbon reduced the biouptake in the lumbriculus by 90%. As we go to some of the other sediments on the right here, the reductions change from 90% to 53, 67, and down to 29% for Berry's Creek study that we did in the lab. And these show progressively increased capacity for the sediment itself to bind the native mercury. So to an extent, the effectiveness of the carbon is controlled by the native bioavailability of the methyl mercury. So from this study, what we could tell was that if the methyl mercury is strongly bound to the sediment to start with, the incremental effectiveness of adding a strong adsorbent is going to be weaker compared to a site where the methyl mercury is not bound that strongly. In each of these sediments, the amount of carbon that we added was, additional activated carbon that we added was 5% by weight. If we go to the next slide here, we can, if we plot the sediment pore water partition constants against the tissue sediment bioaccumulation factors for a range of measurements we did for with and without carbon, for inorganic mercury, which is the squares, and the methyl mercury, which is in the blue circle, we kind of see a relationship here where the bioaccumulation factors are low when the KD is low. And when the KD is high, we get a higher bioaccumulation factor. So the native position constant is impacting how organisms are able to access the mercury, the methyl mercury from these sediments. So in a way, we can think of the native partitioning as a surrogate for bioavailability for additional reduction of the bioavailability. So going on to a pilot study that we did, this was led by Cindy Gilmore, and I helped in that work as well. And this was in a tidal marsh in New England, the Mendel Marsh, Penobscot River, which is impacted with mercury. These were set up, and there was additional funding that came for this work from the Penobscot River Study Group. The design involved 3-by-3-foot plots, and these were replicated plots in two parts of the marsh, and these were set up in three rows of five plots that you can see in the aerial picture here. Each of these plots had different treatments, and they were arranged in different orientations to give us some randomized placement of these plots. There were three replicates per treatment, and the loading rate was 5% by dry weight of soil based on the top 10 centimeters of soil weight. And the treatments were, we had a control plot. There was no additional amendment that was done in the control plot. We added iron chloride, and I believe the iron chloride addition was to be able to double the native iron content in the soil. There was lime addition, and the loading rates are given here. We did a biochar, which was a pine dust biochar, and then we used acetimide, which is a pelletized form of activated carbon. We used a coconut shell activated carbon, which had 50%, the product had 50% by weight of activated carbon. And then these were monitored over a period of time to measure whether the amendment stayed in place and then how effective it was in changing the pore water chemistry and the sediment chemistry. So what you see here on the left, if you look at the arrow here, 1 year after application, when we take cores out and look at it and take a picture, you can see the black region on the top. This is where most of the carbon is. When we go back to the site 7 years after and look at these cores that we take out from the sediment, from this treatment plots, with carbon-treated plots, we seem to see a band of carbon that is a little further into the sediment with a new layer on top, which is paler in color, and part of that is the accretion of the marsh and maybe some sediments that have deposited over the 7 years. And this depth is really short, a few centimeters. So in these marsh environments, the rate at which the marsh is accreting is relatively small. But the interesting thing is visually we could see the carbon still in place. Now, it's one thing to look at it visually, which is at least possible to some extent in these cores, but in many sediment sites, the sediments are so dark in color, one would not be able to see the additional carbon visually. So then one has to measure the carbon, and there are two ways to do that. One can measure the carbon directly as TOC, or total organic carbon, and the problem with that approach in marsh soils or sediments is that the native organic carbon is very high. As I mentioned, the amount of activated carbon that was added was 5%, but the native organic carbon content is about 20 to 30%. So the incremental difference is small, and if we look at the TOC of the control versus the treatment plots, it's difficult to tell statistically what the difference is. So there's another approach to do this, which is a method that we had developed several years ago to look at activated carbon, which involves taking the soil sample and chemically oxidizing away the natural organic matter using a very strong oxidant. It's basically a dichromate and sulfuric acid oxidation. The activated carbon is not oxidized in that chemical environment, and after the native organic carbon is oxidized, we can then put it in a carbon analyzer and measure the carbon content. So that's done in the plots that are shown on the left. My arrow is not moving for some reason, but you can see those plots that are labeled black carbon weight percent. And there are two sets of plots, the central plot and the west plots, and you can see that compared to the control, which is the white bar, the gray and the black bars show much higher levels of carbon in the range of about 10 to 15% sometimes in that zone where we see the black region. So the story here is that there is retention of the carbon, of the activated carbon in the sediments after 7 years. We are able to get a mass balance of about 108% of that carbon. Biochar, a little less, about 50% we could not account for. Let's go to the next slide here. These are the results showing filtered methylmercury in these two plots, the central and the west plots. And early on after the application, after in the first year or so, we could see a reduction, a very obvious reduction in the pore water concentration of methylmercury in both of those plots. And that effect is smothered to some extent over time. So when we go back after 7 years, we could see it in the central plot, could not see it in the west plot. And part of that is related to the new deposition of sediments and accretion of the marsh that's happening in that small plot, which is being influenced by everything else that's going on in the larger treatment site. So here is a summary of those pilot studies, both AC and sedimite, which was the AC sedimite and the pine dust biochars were visually retained in the marsh soils. We could see that after 7 years. And we had some effectiveness of the pore water mercury that was seen even after 7 years, at least in one of those areas where the treatment was performed. So going on to a little more focused study looking at a range of amendments, one of the issues with mercury as opposed to, say, PCBs or other hydrophobic chemicals is, as you heard in Dr. Shukim's talk, that mercury is methylated to form methylmercury. So if there is a large pool of mercury and there are organisms that can do it, there's going to be a continuous production of methylmercury. So any kind of in-situ treatment of methylmercury has to account for this biogeochemical process by which methylmercury is continuously formed, which is different from other static contaminants like PCBs or DDT. And one of the things we learned early on with some of our pilot studies is that in addition to the sorption capacity in the soils or sediments, there is a biological factor which controls the methylation and the demethylation. And the biological factors are in turn controlled by redox conditions in sediments. So that's got a big influence in how much methylmercury is produced and what the bioavailability is and how amendments will change that picture. So we looked at, in addition to activated carbon, we looked at manganese dioxide, and this is some work that Dimitri Vlasopoulos has done in the past, and in collaboration with his work, his team, we looked at, in addition to carbon, looking at redox manipulation with manganese dioxide, and see how that plays out in tidal marsh system. So what you see in the picture here is set up in the tidal marsh in the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, and what you can see are these pipes that have marsh vegetation growing out from them. And these pipes are set at different heights, and the pipes have been filled with sediments that include some native sediments which are very low mercury with some high mercury sediments mixed and blended into these pipes and placed at different elevations within the marsh. So each of these pipes are seeing different changes in redox conditions as the tide goes in and out. And then there are controls, and then in some of the treatments we had 5% activated carbon, and then we have activated carbon with manganese dioxide. The key results from the marsh, we call them, Cindy likes to call them the organ pilot study. These are like organ pipes sticking out of the mud. And what you see here is that if you look at the plots on the top, these are pore water methyl mercury and pore water mercury concentrations in the pipes, and the concentrations go through a change. So on the x-axis you have the months: August, September, October, and November. So the pore water methyl mercury goes up a little bit in the control and then goes down in those 4 months. In the lower elevation plot, you see a gradual decrease, quite a significant decrease from August to September in the control. And if you look at the treatments, the carbon or the carbon plus manganese dioxide, those profiles of change are different. So one of the big differences is that in the presence of activated carbon and manganese dioxide, we seem to see, in most cases, a much reduced pore water and methyl mercury concentration. Activated carbon also does it in some of the plots, but not so much in the lower elevation plot. But in the combination with manganese dioxide, possibly there are two things happening: a manipulation of the redox condition and change in the sorption capacity in the sediments that's influencing how pore water methyl mercury is working out in these controlled pipe experiment. If we look at the concentrations in the soil itself, the methyl mercury concentration, these are nanograms per gram in the soil, it seemed to increase a little bit and then go down in the depth and the 20 centimeters. And in each of these depths, we seem to see a little higher accumulation of methyl mercury in these sediments when these treatments are performed. So although the pore water concentrations seem to go down, there seems to be some accumulation of methyl mercury in these treatments where the enhanced sorption capacity in those sediments are retaining some of the methyl mercury in the sediments. So our next experiment looked at trying to discriminate the effect of the carbon, the manganese dioxide, and AC plus manganese dioxide. And these were set up with sediments that came from Bates Creek mixed with the local sediments from the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. And these were set up in bottles like you see in the picture down below here. So these were slurry experiments with these marsh soils, and we looked at the effectiveness of 5% AC amendment and effectiveness. What we show here in the plot on the top is that if you have compare from the control with respect to the control, there is a reduction in the range of 20 to 80% in the pore water methyl mercury with the carbon addition. And in these experiments, in these slurry experiments, we also see reductions, maybe not so much with just manganese dioxide, and a combination of those two effects in the AC plus manganese oxide dioxide treatment. Cindy also looked at the effect of these different treatments, AC or manganese dioxide or AC plus manganese dioxide, on methylation and demethylation. There was a question a little while ago on the ultimate fate of methyl mercury. So one of the processes is the demethylation process, which is to some extent controlled by the availability of the methyl mercury and the redox condition that's available for the demethylation process. So what you see in the top figure there is the methylation rate, and this was determined by spiking mercury 201. This is one of the stable isotopes of mercury that can be tracked along with the regular mercury. And by looking at a time series, one can then calculate a methylation rate, which is a first-order rate constant. And what you see here is that the methylation rate doesn't seem to change a whole lot compared to the control for the treatments. But the demethylation rate seems to change. The demethylation rate in the lower plot for the control shown in the green bar is comparable to the purple bar, which is the manganese dioxide treatment. But when we have the AC plus manganese dioxide or the, just the AC by itself, those rates are much lower. And what that shows is that the spiked methylmercury 190, so this is the other stable isotope of mercury methyl, this is methylmercury 199, which has been spiked in the system. So at least the freshly spiked methyl 199 mercury is not demethylated at the same rate as what we see in the controls. So there is a difference that's being caused by these amendments in the methylation and demethylation, in at least the demethylation rate, not so much in the methylation rate. And that results in an accumulation of methylmercury in the sediments to some extent. So for example, if you see on the plot in the left, for the control we have about 60 nanograms per gram methylmercury, and in this particular UBC2 sediment, and a higher value of about 120 nanogram per gram in this UBC2 sediment when there is activated carbon in it. However, these other two sites, MBC1 and UBC2, we don't seem to see any difference in the accumulation of methylmercury. So this issue of methylmercury accumulating in sediments when the softening capacity is increased is manifested in some sediments and not so much in other sediments. And we are still trying to understand that process a little better, what types of sediments one might see that accumulation and where not so much. I'm going to move through here talking about some of the work on looking at uptake in benthic animals. So these are studies where we looked at these treatments and how these treatments are influencing uptake into an organism. This is Leptochirus, which is an estuarine amphipod that's often used for bioaccumulation studies for estuarine sites, sediments. And we're looking at impact of amendments in reducing uptake into this organism, and in parallel doing pore water measurements. So when we look at the pore water, and the sediments that we used were either the same sediment that has that we talked about earlier, which had been treated with carbon and left out in the field for 1.5 years, or the sediments that were not treated in the field but were freshly treated with activated carbon. So when we freshly treat those sediments with activated carbon, we get a big drop in filtered methylmercury concentrations shown here in this plot in nanograms per liter. So the green dots are the unamended sediments. We have somewhere between, so these, notice that these are log scale values in nanograms per liter, somewhere between 10 and 100 nanograms per liter. If we freshly add activated carbon, drops down by more than an order of magnitude. But these, the carbon, when it is aged over time with those sediments, there is less effectiveness that we can see, but it's still better than the control sediments in terms of the pore water concentration. But if you come to this plot, which shows methylmercury in nanograms per gram in the sediments, with time, as you can see in this black bar, black dots here, with time, the methylmercury in the sediments are increasing in the activated carbon treated plot. In the control plot, it also increases initially, but seems to stabilize to a value of about 200 nanograms per liter. These were not run long enough to be able to tell if these values would stay there or keep going. But in the sediments that were treated with activated carbon and left in the field for 1.5 years, we have about twice the amount of methylmercury that were in those treated sediments. And that impacts the uptake into organisms. So when you look at methylmercury uptake into organisms, there is that factor increase in the organisms that are ingesting those sediments. So in sediments where addition of an amendment is going to increase the methylmercury residual in the sediments, if those sediments are in contact or organisms are in contact and ingesting those sediments, there is a potential for uptake into those organisms. So that's probably an engineering challenge in terms of figuring out a way of engineering those treatments in the sediments so that benthic organisms are not in contact with carbon-treated zone in sediments. And this can be done with the right kind of an approach for in situ treatment. I'm going to skip through a few slides here because I see I'm running out of time here. I'm already run out of time, I believe. So some of the ongoing work is looking at developing a passive sampler. This is taking a slightly different approach to a passive sampler, where instead of working in the kinetic mode, we're looking at developing a passive sampler, which would involve reaching an equilibrium within a period of deployment. We're developing new polymers that would have affinity for mercury and methyl mercury in the same way as organisms in the sediments come to an equilibrium or a steady state value with its ambient mercury concentration. And that's showing some initial promise, and I don't have much time to go through that right now, so I'm going to skip through and come to the summary conclusions here because I do want to take some questions. So in summary, activated carbon can be an effective tool in reducing methyl mercury risk by reducing methyl mercury in pore waters. Activated carbon was more effective in reducing methyl mercury than total mercury in most sites. Now, the good thing about that is methyl mercury is the species that typically drives risk at many of these sites. Efficacy of the activated carbon for methyl mercury ranges from no impact in some sites to 50 times increase in KD. And as I said, the native KD has a role to play in the effectiveness of an amendment. Average pore water reduction is about 50% across many of the studies that we did. AC is most effective for methyl mercury in soils with naturally low KD, and we talked about that. And that's what we understand at this point. And our ongoing work is developing equilibrium passive sampling for methyl mercury, and I'll end with this concluding slide, which shows James, Cindy and I standing on one of these platforms in the marsh that Cindy set up at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. This work would not have been possible without the collaboration with many people listed here and support from that we also received from the Dow Chemical Company, the DOD Certified BSCCP program, and the Penobscot River Study Group. And finally, a disclosure statement that I have a couple of patents related to adding carbon into sediments for treatment, and that is being transitioned into practice through a startup company that I'm involved in. With that, thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Great. Thanks, Supal. That was a wonderful talk. We've got a bunch of questions that have come in, so thanks to everyone for submitting questions. If you continue to have questions while we're asking questions, feel free to ask those as well, and we'll probably get to those by email because we're a little bit short on time, but we'll go through a handful of questions that have come in so far. So the first one, first question here is there any possibility that activated carbon amendments could increase the bioavailability of mercury?
That's a very good question, and as I showed in one of the slides, that one of the issues with methyl mercury is that it's continuously produced, and at any point of time, the methyl mercury that's available for organism uptake is a balance between the accumulation that has happened and the rate at which methyl mercury is probably getting either degraded biologically or abiotically from the system. So the steady state value of methyl mercury is going to depend on many factors. It is possible to create a situation where you might build up methyl mercury high enough in sediments in a given scenario where ultimate uptake into organism is higher. And I think the challenge for engineers and scientists working to develop an in-situ remedy is going to be to be able to look out for those possibilities and engineer a system where we can minimize that chance. So I think in a nutshell, I should say, there is a chance of that happening, and we have seen that evidence in a certain situation that one could cause increased uptake into organism, but I believe there are ways to engineer these systems so we minimize that possibility.
Sounds good. Thanks. The next question is, have any studies been done on the condition of invertebrates in the treated areas, especially as to whether carbon amendments sequestered nutrients to a detrimental extent?
That is, again, a great and very relevant question, and this has come up many times, and What I would do is I would point to a couple of review articles that have been written on this subject, which synthesizes work by us and many other people to put into context what kind of concern one should have and one should prepare for and try to minimize. So in a summary, what I would say is that there have been negative effects of an amendment that has been seen more so in lab studies at high doses. In the field, when we do benthic community assessments over time after amending, we rarely see an effect. But I will be happy to point to, maybe this can be sent out or attached in terms of this webinar, a couple of review articles which have really synthesized all that information together.
Sounds good. Now, this will be the last question that we'll take. If you've already submitted a question that we weren't able to get to, we'll send those to the presenters, and they can address those in an email to you, and also feel free to email the presenters if you have any additional questions that have come up. So the last question I'll read here is, the Penobscot River pilot test did not seem to be a great example of the permanence of methylmercury reduction, as only some effect was present after 7 years. Is this mainly because of recontamination of the new sediment from internal sources within the system?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge whenever we are trying to interpret effectiveness of a large-scale treatment from a small-scale demonstration plot. One of the things that happened in a small-scale plot is that the ambient concentrations and influxes of mercury and methylmercury continues at the same rate. And any kind of in-situ treatment is not going to be effective when everything around is contaminated. So oftentimes it's really challenging to interpret long-term effects from a small plot, because the ambient water concentrations, the tidal water concentrations, the new sediments that are depositing and sediments all around that small plot is remaining at those untreated concentration levels. So, you know, in my mind, that is part of the issue of being able to interpret long-term effects from a small treatment plot, pilot plot, sitting in the middle of a large, very large contaminated area.
Sounds good. Thanks, and thanks for your presentation. At this point, we will conclude the webinar. And I want to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation that was given today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments and continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. I'd like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any future webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter Tech Direct and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage you to visit the SRP website for more information about the program. You can also follow SRP on Twitter. With that, it's time to conclude today's webinar and this webinar series. If you submitted an online question that we did not have time to get to, we will pass those questions along to the presenters who can follow up with you directly to address them. If you have any additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar home page on CLUIN. So with that, once again, I'd like to say thanks to our presenters, Helen Shi Kim and Upal Ghosh, for their time preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.